Chapter 13. The Ninth Harbinger. The Prophecy. We walked down the marble steps, and then along the reflecting pool. "A question," I said, breaking the silence. "Ask," he replied. "The Ninth Harbinger is like the Eighth in that it doesn't so much concern a piece of the mystery of Isaiah 9:10, but the whole prophecy." "Yes, but it's different from the Eighth, in that the Eighth speaks primarily of what is, in the present tense, and the Ninth speaks about what would be, in the future tense. Is that right?"
"Correct."
"Why is that important, the distinction?" "Because Isaiah 9:10 exists in two realms. In one realm, it's the voice of a nation proclaiming a vow in defiance of God. But in the other realm, it's the voice of a prophet, the voice of Isaiah, and of God speaking through him. It's a prophecy. And as a prophecy, it's a judgment on the nation's defiance and arrogance, and a warning, a sign foretelling its future. It's a message sent from God, and in such a way as to fall on the entire nation so that all the people will know it." "So the Ninth Harbinger is a manifestation of Isaiah 9:10 in the form of a prophecy, as both a vow and a prophecy," he said, "and given in such a way as to fall on the nation." "So then, to fall on America?"
"Yes."
We walked on for a time, in silence, as I pondered his words. Then he came to a stop and asked me for the seal he had just given me. Upon receiving it, he began to reveal its mystery. "The Ninth Harbinger," he said. "In the wake of the calamity, the nation issues its response in the form of a vow. The vow sets the nation on a course of defiance, a course that ends in judgment. The words of the vow become part of a prophetic revelation given to the nation as a whole, an indictment of its rebellion, a foretelling of its future, a warning of its judgment. The Ninth Harbinger, the prophecy." "Then according to the mystery, there would have to have been a prophetic word given in the wake of 9/11 to fall on the nation." He didn't answer, but just kept walking. "A prophecy given, but not by a prophet?" Still he was silent. "And the words of the prophecy came true?" He stopped. "Look at that," he said, pointing forward. In the distance ahead of us was the massive dome of the Capitol building. "The center of the American government," he said. "Is that the place?" I asked. He didn't answer, but resumed walking. We continued until we reached the foot of the Capitol steps, where we came to a stop. "Nouriel, when do you think the leaders of ancient Israel first uttered their vow of defiance?"
"Probably right after the calamity."
"And what would right after the calamity be with regard to America?"
"The time right after 9/11.
"Like September 12th?
"That would be right after. Why?"
"On September 12th, 2001, he said, "the morning after the attack, the United States Senate and House of Representatives convened to issue a joint resolution responding to 9/11. It was to be the nation's first official response to the calamity."
"So it was here," I said.
"The vow must be spoken on behalf of the entire nation. Here, where the nation's representatives gather, the two representative bodies of the American Congress, here would be the most perfect place for it to happen."
"The House of Representatives and the Senate."
"And of the two, the Senate is the upper or highest of representative bodies. And the highest representative of the highest body is the Senate Majority Leader. The highest representative of the nation's highest representative body in position to deliver the nation's response to the calamity." We began ascending the marble steps. "On the morning after September 11th, he said, "America would issue its response to the calamity in the form of a joint resolution of Congress. The one appointed to present the nation's response was the Senate Majority Leader. The act would be critical, for as a nation responds to a divine warning, its future is determined." Finally, we reached the top of the stairs, where the prophet continued his account. "The smoke still hovered over Ground Zero as the American government prepared to deliver its response to 9/11 before a nation and a world waiting to see what that response would be. The Senate Majority Leader made his way to the podium on the Senate floor to present it. "Mr. President," he said, "I sent a resolution to the desk." The assistant legislative clerk then read the document. "A joint resolution,
expressing the sense of the Senate and the House of Representatives regarding the terrorist attacks launched against the United States on September 11, 2001. The clerk continued the reading of the resolution, a condemnation of the attacks, an expression of condolences, and then a call for unity, a war against terrorism, and the punishment of those responsible for the attack and all who assisted them. That would all be expected, I said. It would be, said the prophet. But then the Senate Majority Leader began his address. At the end of the speech would come the climax. These are the words proclaimed by the Senate Majority Leader on Capitol Hill the morning after 9/11 to present and sum up the nation's response to the calamity. Listen. I know that there is only the smallest measure of inspiration that can be taken from this devastation, but there is a passage in the Bible from Isaiah that I think speaks to all of us at times like this. The bricks have fallen down, but we will rebuild with dressed stone. The fig trees have been felled, but we will replace them with cedars. I was speechless for several moments. I don't know what I expected to hear, but what I heard left me without words and with my heart racing. I was completely stunned. The ancient vow had actually been proclaimed to the nation from Capitol Hill. The vow of fallen bricks and sycamores had echoed through the halls of the United States Congress, and all on the morning after 9/11. How, I asked, how could that have happened? How could it have happened with a vice presidential candidate, or with a stone or the tree? How could any of it have happened? It had to happen, and so it did. But he was identifying America as a nation under judgment. Yes, unwittingly. The Majority Leader of the United States Senate was publicly pronouncing judgment on America. Blindly, he replied, having no idea what he was pronouncing. As far as he knew, he was only delivering an inspiring speech. But unknowingly playing his part in a prophetic mystery. Yes, and so the words of the ancient vow were now officially joined to America and 9/11. And just as Isaiah's recording of the vow transformed it into a matter of national record and a prophetic word for all the people, so now the same words were now officially recorded in the annals of Congress as a matter of national record. But the Senate Majority Leader wasn't a prophet. No, but you said it's a prophecy. How can someone who isn't a prophet bring forth a prophetic word? In the Gospel of John, he replied, the 11th chapter, the high priest Caiaphas is recorded as saying, "It is necessary that one man should die for the people." It was the beginning of the plot that would end with the crucifixion of the Messiah. But it was something else as well. It was also a prophecy, namely, that one man, Jesus, would die for the people to save them. Caiaphas wasn't a prophet. He was an ungodly man, and yet he prophesied. It wasn't the man. It was the office he held. He was speaking, as the gospel puts it, not of his own initiative, but prophesying by virtue of his office as the chief representative of the nation. So the Senate Majority Leader was prophesying by virtue of his office? The Senate Majority Leader was the highest representative of America's highest representative body. By virtue of that office, he became the instrument to represent the nation, to speak on its behalf, to give voice to its response, and to deliver a prophetic word. So someone can prophesy without being a prophet? How does that happen? The word is inspiration. When a prophet speaks, he does so under the inspiration of the Spirit. But prophets aren't the only ones who can speak or act under inspiration. The Bible itself is called the inspired word of God because it was written by those under the inspiration of God's Spirit, not only by prophets. Even those who have no idea what they're doing or saying, even those who act and speak from other motives, as did Caiaphas, even a politician, well-meaning or not, may speak under the inspiration of God. Inspiration, I said. Didn't he use that word in the speech? He did. He said, "I know there is only the smallest measure of inspiration that can be taken from this devastation." He used it to introduce the prophecy. But he didn't intend to use it that way. Of course not. He used it to mean This is for the purpose of inspiring you. But the word means more than that. Even in its most literal definition, inspiration, from the Latin inspiratio, means to be inbreathed or blown upon. Blown upon by the wind, by the breath, by the spirit. That which is inspired is God-breathed, spirit-blown. The word is defined as a supernatural or divine influence upon the prophets, the apostles, and the sacred writers, or upon men to enable them to communicate divine truth. So the word has a double meaning. Yes, just as the prophetic words of Caiaphas had a double meaning. That which he intended to say and that which he didn't. What he didn't intend, that was the prophecy. So too with the Senate Majority Leader. The message he intended to say was, the following words are going to inspire you. And that's how most people would have understood it. Yes, said the prophet. But then there was the message he didn't intend to say, which was this. The following words do not come from my own initiative, but are of divine origin, the same origin and influence by which the prophet spoke. What you're about to hear is a prophetic message. So even the word inspiration came forth by inspiration. Yes, that as well as the prophetic address. What do you mean? I asked. When you send a letter, you address it. You identify the one to whom it's being sent. So too, biblical prophecies often contain prophetic addresses, introductions, identifying the one or the ones to whom it's being sent. It's there in Isaiah's prophecy. The Lord has sent forth a word to Jacob, Israel, Ephraim, Samaria, all the people. So the prophecy is addressed to the people of Jacob, Israel, and Samaria. But now the same prophecy, the same message, is about to be given, prophetically sent to a different people and a different nation. America. Yes. So then it has to be readdressed. The prophetic address has to be changed. Exactly, he said. And so it was. The majority leader omitted the original prophetic address that identified Israel as its recipient and put a different one in its place. There is a passage in the Bible from Isaiah that I think speaks to all of us at times like this. Again, it's a message of two realms and double meaning. What the speaker meant to say was this. There's a passage in the Bible to bring comfort in times of crisis like this. And of course, the Bible is filled with countless passages of comfort and encouragement. But Isaiah 9:10 was not one of them. No, said the prophet. Not by a very long shot. So what he didn't mean to say, but actually said was this. There's a message from Scripture now given and speaking to America. The message is a prophetic word of warning sent to a nation that once knew God and appointed to be given and to speak at this particular time, the time when a nation is standing in danger of judgment. And then, after proclaiming the ancient vow, the Senate Majority Leader added on his own words. The bricks have fallen down, but we will rebuild with dressed stone. The fig trees have been felled, but we will replace them with cedars. That is what we will do. That is what we will do. Just six words, but all that was needed to transform the vow. No longer was it an ancient vow of an ancient people. No longer was it merely a quotation. It was now the vow itself. It was now the vowing. The we of ancient Israel had transformed into the we of America. The act of national defiance was taking place not in the ancient capital of an ancient kingdom. It was now transpiring on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. The ancient judgment drama was now playing itself out on the floor of the United States Senate, and then the Senate Majority Leader brought it to its logical conclusion. That is what we will do. We will rebuild, and we will recover. It was the final restating of the vow. That is what we will do. In other words, America will do exactly as ancient Israel had done in its days of judgment. Which is the word that as in that is what we will do, can only refer to the ancient vow. In other words, America would continue in its defiance of God, in its departure from his ways, in its refusing to hear his call to return. Only it would do so all the more. America would follow the course of the ancient vow. So Isaiah 9:10 is now being transformed into national policy. You could say that. And what happened after the vow was spoken? I asked. Everyone was in full agreement, he replied. They had no idea what it was they had just heard. No, they had no idea what had happened. That which had gone forth from Capitol Hill was the proclamation that identifies a nation in rebellion against God and the pronouncement of judgment upon that nation. And what happened after that? What happened after that? After that, it would all come true. It was a prophecy. It foretold the nation's future course. That is what we will do. America would choose the same course as that of ancient Israel, enact the same strategy, and walk in the same footsteps. It was all prophesied on the very morning after 9/11. He spoke of the cutting down of the tree. Did he know there was an actual tree cut down by the calamity at Ground Zero, and that it bore the same name as the fallen tree of Isaiah 9:10? No, he had no idea. His version translated it as fig tree. Nevertheless, it was the biblical shakam, the fig mulberry tree, the sycamore. And even if he had known what he was saying, what it all meant, he could have had no idea that it was actually being fulfilled. When he proclaimed the prophecy on September 12th, Ground Zero was still a disaster site and cut off from the public. And it was only in later days that the story of the sycamore of Ground Zero would come out, and yet he spoke of it. Nor could he have known on September 12th that one day a crane would lower a 20-ton gazit stone onto Ground Zero, where the fallen bricks had laid. That would come true 3 years after he foretold it. And the cedar tree, I said, there's no way he could have known that a tree matching the biblical Erez tree would actually be planted in place of the fallen sycamore. That, too, would only happen years later, and only because someone decided to donate that particular tree. He couldn't have had any idea, and yet he prophesied it, that the one would be planted in place of the other. It was all prophesied the day after 9/11. It was all there and recorded in the annals of Congress for the whole nation to know. The nation would respond to its calamity just as ancient Israel had responded to its calamity. It would pursue a course of defiance on a path of judgment. I was silent. The prophet paused before saying anything more, allowing me time to process what I was hearing before showing me something else. Come, Noriel. I want you to see something. He led me to the other side of the Capitol and pointed to a nearby building. Do you know what that is? I feel I should. What you're looking at is the Supreme Court, the highest court in the land. And yet there sits a much higher court than this, by which nations are judged. According to a biblical requirement, before a truth can be established or a judgment passed in a court of law, the matter must be confirmed by two witnesses. One witness shall not rise against a man concerning any iniquity or any sin that he commits. By the mouth of two or three witnesses, the matter shall be established. The principle of two witnesses applies first to the legal realm, but it can also be applied to the realm of nations. In the case of America, the Isaiah 9:10 connection would likewise be established by two witnesses. The Senate Majority Leader on the day after 9/11, he was the first witness. Correct. And the second witness? The Vice Presidential candidate 3 years later, on the anniversary of 9/11. Both would speak the same words. Correct. And both would bear witness of the joining of America to ancient Israel, and of 9/11 to Isaiah 9:10, the one speaking of what would be, and the other of what was, that the vow was being fulfilled. And neither of the two, I added, had any idea what they were saying, or what the other was saying, or how their words were actually being fulfilled in reality. No, said the prophet, which only further compounds the weight of their testimony. And it was all set in motion on the very day after 9/11, here, with a warning and the pronouncement of judgment, The prophecy was proclaimed to the nation from Capitol Hill, and it would all come true. There was silence. The revelation of the ninth harbinger was finished, and I was still shaken. This obscure, mysterious prophecy had actually been proclaimed from the seat of the American government, and the speaker linked it all to 9/11. That, together with everything else, all the connections, all the twists and quirks, the reenactments, the replaying, the ancient mystery manifesting in America, it left me shaken. I wanted to be silent, to try to take it all in. But I had the sense that if I didn't say something soon, he'd be gone, and it would be the end. It was the last harbinger. So I broke the silence. I have a question. Yes? If America is following the same pattern as ancient Israel, witnessing the same signs, uttering the same words, reenacting the same acts, responding with the same response, yes? How can it escape suffering the same fate? He didn't answer, so again I spoke. And if the proclaiming of the vow was just the first stage of judgment for Israel, and not the last, then what about America? What does the future hold? Chapter 14. There Comes a Second. Again the prophet was silent, and he gazed out into the expanse of the Washington Mall, appearing to be preoccupied. This was the last harbinger, I said, trying to get his attention. What's next? What's next? What happens now? I asked. What does it all lead to? The harbingers are signs of what, Noriel? Of warning. And of what else? The rejection of the warning. And what's the purpose of a warning? To prevent something from happening, a threat, a danger. So what happens if a warning is given, if the alarms go off, and nobody listens? Then it happens. So then it happens. But does it have to happen? I asked. If the warning is rejected, then yes, it has to happen. But people can change, and a nation can alter its course. Yes, that's the hope. That's the purpose of a warning. A changed course means a changed end. But an unchanged course means an unchanged end. Then it has to happen. As it did to ancient Israel? Each case is unique, but the overall progression is the same. So if America's course doesn't change, then what? Another 9/11? Another 9/11 could be, or a different 9/11. Or was 9/11 itself a harbinger? And what does that mean, I asked. The first Assyrian invasion of Israel was a calamity in and of itself. But at the same time, it was a harbinger of a still greater calamity to come, a warning of the nation's destruction. A calamity can also be a warning. But what would 9/11 be a harbinger of? It was the day of falling symbols, but what is the fall of a symbol, he asked. I have no idea, I replied. Is it not also the symbol of a fall? I'm not getting it, but you will. So the first warning's given, and then a final calamity. More than one warning may be given, said the prophet. If one alarm is ignored, then there comes a second. Then there comes a second, or there may come a second? Then there comes a second. Then a second warning is coming, I asked. A second warning, he said. A second alarm. A second shaking. A second shaking of America? He turned his gaze so that he was now looking directly into my eyes as he gave his response. There comes a second, he said again. Then he handed me a seal. It was the same one I had just given him back. The seal of the ninth harbinger? I just returned it to you. Yes, he replied. Then he began descending the Capitol steps. I followed after him, but hearing my footsteps, he stopped and turned around. No, Noriel, he said. That was the last harbinger. Our time is finished. He resumed his descent. I stayed where I was, but I shouted after him as I had done before, only now with more urgency at the thought that it might be my last chance of getting an answer. So what do I do now? About what? About everything. About everything you've shown me. You don't forget it. That's not enough. I need something specific. What do I do now, specifically? When he got to the bottom of the first set of steps, he stopped, turned around, and responded. Specifically, he said. Yes, specifically, I replied. You go home. You go home, and you watch. And what am I watching for? There comes a second, he replied. He descended the next set of stairs as I finished descending the first. Then from the terrace, in between the two staircases, I watched as he walked away from the Capitol and down the Washington Mall, until he disappeared from my sight. Anna waited for something more, for the account to continue. She was hoping it wasn't the end of the story. But Noriel was silent. So what did you do after he left? She asked. I went home. And I watched. For what exactly? For what exactly, I wasn't sure. I focused on the prophecy. I went back to the library and spent hours and hours searching, poring through the commentaries on Isaiah 9:10. And I found a match. What the prophet said to me when he left and what the commentary said about Isaiah 9:10, they matched. How? In one of the commentaries, I found this. Divine anger, being a remedial force, will not cease until its purposes are wrought out. Therefore, if Israel resisted one expression of the anger, another must be found. And that means what? She asked. It means that there was a purpose behind the first calamity, that first invasion of the land by the Assyrians. Its purpose was remedial, to correct, to wake up the nation, to turn it back to God, a purpose of redemption. But you knew that already, she replied. What did you get from the commentary that was different or that matched what the prophet told you? What it's saying is that those purposes won't stop until they're fulfilled. So if a nation rejects one expression of that purpose, another must be found. The force or purpose will manifest itself again in another form. That's what I found in the one commentary. And then in a second commentary on Isaiah 9:10, I found this. God's first acts of judgment did not result in the transformation or repentance of his people, Israel. The purpose of God's initial disciplinary punishment was to restore his people, but the people stubbornly refused to turn to him. Since the first act of discipline did not bring about a humble confession of sins, a second punishment was necessary. The commentaries were consistent in linking Isaiah 9:10 with the same principle. And then, in another commentary, I found this. As the first stage of the judgments has been followed by no true conversion to Jehovah, the Almighty Judge, there comes a second. There comes a second. That's what the prophet kept saying to you the day you last saw him. He kept saying it because he knew it wasn't the end. Isaiah 9:10 is the beginning, the first link in a chain of progression. There's more to it. It leads to something else. So then if Isaiah 9:10 is joined to America with the harbingers, it means that what happened on 9/11 isn't the end of the matter. Then it's not over. There's more to come. Yes, then there comes a second. A second what exactly? A second warning, a sounding of the alarm, a second chastening, a second shaking. But what exactly? What form does it take? The prophet spoke of the harbingers as symbols. That was a clue. The World Trade Center was a symbol of America's global financial and economic power. So what would such a fall foreshadow? An economic fall? As in a financial and economic collapse. The collapse that began the Great Recession? Yes. The collapse of the American and global economy is connected to 9/11? Yes. But how? It all goes back to the prophecy. Everything. The collapse of Wall Street, the rise and fall of the credit market, the war in Iraq, the collapse of the housing market, the foreclosures, the defaults, the bankruptcies, the government takeovers, everything, politics, foreign policy, world history, everything that happened after. It all goes back to the prophecy and to the ancient mystery. That's a pretty big proposition, she said. In fact, it's colossal. I realize that, he said. And nobody else realizes it? All the economists and experts and think tanks and intelligence agencies, they have no idea? I don't know. I guess not. But how do you know? She asked. How did you put it all together? I told you, he replied. It wasn't me. It was what I was told. I understand that, with the harbingers. But now you're talking about what happened after you were shown the harbingers. So how did you come to know these things if the last time you saw the prophet was on Capitol Hill? But it wasn't the last time. He reappeared? When we parted that day on the Capitol steps, it was the first time he left me without a seal, or without a new seal. So I assumed there was nothing more to be revealed. I didn't think I'd ever see him again. Still, occasionally I'd walk alongside the Hudson to the place where we first met, in the hope that he'd reappear. But he never did. Several years passed, and just when I had given up any hope of seeing him again, he reappeared? He reappeared. But the last time you saw him, he told you that his time with you was finished. It was finished. He appeared the first time to reveal the first part of the mystery. The first part was complete. But there was more. So he appeared again, but this time to reveal the second part of the mystery? Because there comes a second. Chapter 15. The Isaiah 9:10 Effect. At that, he was quiet. She was quiet as well, thinking it right to give him a chance to rest from speaking, but at the same time, concerned that if she waited too long, he might not continue. Finally, she broke the silence. You are planning to tell me the second part of the mystery, she asked. As long as you have the time, he replied. Forget time, she said. I want to know the second part. I know how busy you are. Not anymore, Nouriel. I just wanted to make sure. Wait, before you continue, what if we go for a walk? I need to walk, if that's okay with you. It's fine. They left the office, took an elevator down to the first floor, exited the building, and began walking down the street. They would walk down many streets that night, passing office buildings, stores, street vendors, apartment houses, and others also walking the city streets that night. But the two were largely oblivious to their surroundings, caught up in the ancient mystery and the words of the prophet. So when did you see him again? She asked. I was working on a project that had me in Lower Manhattan for several weeks. During my free time, I'd go for walks around the area. One day, during one of those walks, I stopped in front of the New York Stock Exchange. I was staring at it, at the side with the columns, the famous side. I don't remember exactly what I was thinking when I heard the voice of the prophet. It had been several years since I last heard it. You didn't forget, did you? He said. I turned around. He hadn't changed, nor had his long dark coat. He looked the same as when I last saw him. Forget what? I asked. What you were shown. I recorded everything, but no, I didn't forget. Good. And how have you been, Nouriel? It was the first time he ever asked me that. Okay, I guess, I replied. And you? What have you been up to these past few years? Watching, he answered. Watching. And now to begin the second part. The second part of the mystery. Are you ready to begin? I don't think I've ever been ready. Then let's begin. What concerns us now is that which comes after, starting with the prophecy. What comes after Isaiah 9:10? What do you mean? What comes after Isaiah 9:10? Isaiah 9:11? Not the number, the words. I can't remember offhand. Isaiah 9:10. The bricks have fallen, but we will rebuild with hewn stone. The sycamores have been cut down, but we will plant cedars in their place. Now Isaiah 9:11. Therefore, The Lord shall set up the adversaries of Rezin against him and spur his enemies on. So what's going on in Isaiah 9:11, he asked. The nation's first shaking is followed by a second? And why is that? Because the nation didn't wake up or turn back after the first. Isaiah 9:10 is a vow of defiance. Isaiah 9:11 is a prophecy of future calamity. The two are connected. The one leads into the other. The first brings about the second. So the vow brings about the nation's future calamities, I asked. The vow, he replied, but not the vow alone. If it were only a vow and nothing more, it would have ended differently. It's what the nation did once the vow was made that determined its future. Which was? It fulfilled the vow with quarried stones and sycamores. The nation embarked on a campaign to rebuild and fortify itself, to emerge stronger and greater than before. So, by executing the vow to defy the first calamity, the nation ends up ushering in the second. Or the second disaster is brought about by the very campaign to prevent it. But why? What would happen, Nouriel, if a gardener tried to remove a weed from his garden by cutting off its leaves, he asked. The leaves would grow back, I replied. And if he cuts off its stem, it would sprout another. His efforts would be doomed to fail. You can't solve a problem by dealing with its symptoms, its manifestations. You have to deal with the cause behind it. In the case of the gardener, the cause lies hidden beneath the surface, in the roots. So even if he solves one problem, another will reappear, and another, until he finally deals with the underlying problem, the root. So in other words, Israel's real problem was a spiritual one, its separation from God. Everything else was just a symptom or manifestation of the underlying problem. So the vow to rebuild is like a gardener attempting to remove a weed by cutting off its leaves. Exactly. The ultimate problem wasn't national security or defense or the Assyrians or even the attack. If a nation's underlying problem is spiritual, then all the political, economic, or military solutions will do nothing to remove it. Such things can only treat symptoms, the bricks and the sycamores. A spiritual problem can only be solved by a spiritual solution. Apart from that, every solution will end up producing another crisis. So the only solution is to return to God. But Israel would choose otherwise. The nation would harden itself, seeking to come back stronger without addressing its spiritual descent. And the strategy appeared to be working for a time. The clearing away of the ruins, the construction, and the sight of a nation rebuilding itself created a sense of national resurgence. But it was all an illusion. The judgment hadn't been averted, only masked. The root problem was never addressed. They were moving farther and farther away from God. The resurgence was hollow. They had vowed to rebuild, but what they were building was a house of cards, and in time it would all collapse. And it all began with a vow. It was the vow that set it all in motion, he said. The same spirit of defiance that led to the vow would eventually lead Israel to reassert itself, to flaunt its strength, and through a series of strategic maneuvers to challenge the Assyrian Empire. That challenge would lead to calamity. So it was the vow and the spirit behind the vow that triggered a chain of events that would ultimately bring about the nation's destruction. The harbingers are manifestations of the vow, I said. So is it inevitable that the harbingers lead to calamity? The harbingers lead either to calamity or redemption. If heeded, they lead to redemption. If not, then to calamity. Now, it's been years, Nouriel, but is it possible that you still have the last seal? I reached into my coat pocket and pulled it out. The one he gave you at the Capitol? Anna asked. Yes, with the image of the scroll on it, the seal of the ninth harbinger. But you gave up on seeing him again. That's right. So why did you still have it with you? I didn't know I did have it until I reached into my pocket. For a time, after that last meeting, I made sure to keep it with me as I did with every seal. But after giving up hope of seeing him again, I wasn't as careful to make sure. Still, it was there in the pocket of my coat. And that's what I just happened to be wearing that day. So you gave him the seal. And as he examined it, he began to speak. If a nation rejects the call of God to return, and if the harbingers aren't heeded, then comes a second stage. So we move now to the second stage, within which are contained four mysteries. Four mysteries. Do you see this? He asked as he pointed to the image on the seal, to what looked like a shadow around the scroll, a shadowy double image. It was faint, and nothing that would have struck me or anyone as noteworthy. It's significant? I asked. It's a double image, a second image. A second image as in there comes a second? I asked. As in there comes a second, yes. So what would it mean? The prophecy has a second part. It leads to something else, to a second manifestation. The Isaiah 9:10 effect. Which is what? This. The attempt of a nation to defy the course of its judgment, apart from repentance, will instead set in motion a chain of events to bring about the very calamity it sought to avert. And this all has to do with America? I asked. 7 years after 9/11, he said, the American economy collapsed, triggering a global economic implosion. Behind it all, and all that followed, was something much deeper than economics. Behind the collapse of Wall Street and the American economy was Isaiah 9:10. How? The explanations for an economic collapse are endless, he said. No one factor stands alone, and one can go back in time as far as one chooses to search for causes. But according to the Isaiah 9:10 effect, the second calamity must be effectively born out of the first and out of the nation's response to that first calamity. So then the collapse of the economy and Wall Street would have to somehow go back to 9/11. And it all does go back to 9/11, he said. The smoke was still hovering over Ground Zero when the ancient vow of defiance was proclaimed from Capitol Hill. In the days and years that followed, the nation would attempt to fulfill that vow. The rebuilding was never just about Ground Zero, but about rebuilding the entire nation. Remember what was proclaimed over the hewn stone. It will forever remain a symbolic cornerstone for the rebuilding of New York and the nation. And when the ancient vow was proclaimed in its entirety, it happened in Washington, D.C., the nation's capital. In both cases, it clearly had to do with more than Ground Zero in New York. It was about America as a nation. And it would be the nation as a whole that carried out the vow. Just as it happened in ancient Israel, it would happen in post-9/11 America. The vow would be turned into reality. Isaiah 9:10 would become the nation's foreign and domestic policy. How so? What did "we will rebuild" mean for ancient Israel, he asked. It meant they would repair the damage and rebuild their fallen buildings, towers, homes. And their walls, he added. They would rebuild their walls and fortify their defenses so as to become invulnerable to future attacks. In the same way, America, after 9/11, would embark on a campaign to rebuild its walls of protection, to strengthen and fortify its systems of defense. The campaign would mean the establishing of the Department of Homeland Security, the launching of a global war against terror, and two conventional wars abroad, one in Afghanistan and the other in Iraq. It was all a reaction to 9/11. America was doing exactly as ancient Israel had done in Isaiah 9:10, attempting to defy the first calamity. In fact, the speech that would launch the nation's war on terror would contain the words, "We will rebuild." America was waging war against 9/11, trying to reverse its consequences, overcome its impact, and nullify its danger. So in the years following the attack, American foreign and domestic policy was, in effect, a translation of the ancient vow. But was it wrong, I asked? What choice was there? Is it wrong for a gardener to cut off the stem of a weed, he asked, instead of dealing with its root? The issue was deeper. You can't solve a spiritual problem with a military or political solution. Apart from a return to God, the root issue remains untouched and will manifest again in a different form. It's in this that the Isaiah 9:10 effect begins to operate. A nation's attempt at defying judgment apart from repentance ends up setting in motion a future calamity. In its campaign to strengthen itself, it ends up bringing about its own weakening. So then, as America vowed to emerge stronger than before and wage war against 9/11, the Isaiah 9:10 effect was set in motion. Yes, and each campaign born of that defiance would end up producing a backlash. How so, I asked. The campaign to strengthen America's national security and defenses would require massive expenditures. The war on terror, the military campaigns in Afghanistan and Iraq, would add multiplied billions of dollars to the federal budget. Funds and resources that otherwise would have been used to strengthen the American economy were now diverted and drained away from investment. The war in Iraq would impel a surging of oil prices, further draining the nation's gross domestic product. The massive amount of governmental spending in support of the nation's war on terror would lead to the skyrocketing of the national debt, further draining its economy. And beyond the financial consequences, what America began in the wake of 9/11 would end up further dividing the nation. And it would all lead up to the economic collapse? In part, he said. And for all that, it would be yet another manifestation of the Isaiah 9:10 effect that would bring about the collapse of the American and global economy. And this, too, was born out of the ruins of 9/11. The most critical effect of the calamity on the American and global economy would begin 6 days after the attack. As a response to the calamity? Yes, he said, as in the ancient vow. In January 2001, with the American economy beginning to slow down, the Federal Reserve began reducing the target interest rate, lowering it to 3.5% by the summer of that year. Then came 9/11. The first economic impact of the attack was the closing down of the New York Stock Exchange the same day. The market would remain closed for 6 days. When it reopened the following Monday, it would suffer the largest point crash in Wall Street history up to that time. The attack had inflicted a damaging blow to an already fragile economy. In the days and months after September 11th, there was a pervading fear that the calamity would cause the economy to hemorrhage. The repercussions of 9/11 and of the nation's response to it would continue to affect the economy long after those initial fears had vanished, along with the ruins of Ground Zero, long after even what appeared to be an economic rebound. September 11th would not only continue to affect the American economy, but would also alter it and in so doing change the global economy. So what happens 6 days after the attack? The Isaiah 9:10 effect begins with a nation's response to the first calamity. So the effect would begin with the proclaiming of the vow on Capitol Hill the next day. Yes, said the prophet, but those were words. We will rebuild. It would be the following Monday that those words would be translated into reality. It was the day that the Federal Reserve attempted to inject liquidity into the market in a campaign to avert economic disaster and ensure that America would indeed rebuild and recover. As ancient Israel had attempted to defy the consequences of its first calamity. Yes, except that the hewn stones of America's recovery were primarily economic. So on the first Monday after 9/11, the Federal Reserve slashed its target interest rate still further. As the first concrete act of the nation's rebuilding, the rate had already been lowered to 3.5%, but the extreme nature of 9/11 would now cause it to begin descending to extreme levels. That Monday morning of September 17th, the Federal Reserve lowered the target interest rate by 50 basis points. Over the next 3 months, it would be slashed several more times until hitting 1.75% on December 11th, 2001. September 11th would force the interest rate below the rate of inflation, which is equivalent to creating free money. The Treasury would continue its extreme suppression of interest rates over an extended period of time. By June of 2003, the rate would reach 1%. And would remain under 2% for several years. Only after that would it be adjusted upward. But the severe slashing and prolonged suppression of interest rates in reaction to 9/11 would set in motion a chain of events that would bring down the American and global economy. How exactly? I asked. The extreme rates would open up an era of easy money, he explained. Easy loans, easy borrowing, and easier mortgages. Easier mortgages would cause an already rising housing market to explode beyond all standard economic fundamentals, creating an unprecedented housing and building boom. The exploding housing market would lead homeowners to borrow and spend against the rising value of their homes. The phenomenon would create credit bubbles throughout the economy. This, in turn, would encourage massive inflows of capital from Asia to compound the problem. The stock market would surge along with the volume of monies borrowed and leveraged, and the effect would spread throughout the world. The post-9/11 slashing of interest rates would be copied by central banks across the globe, meaning that the same post-9/11 dynamics at work in America were now reproduced throughout the world, with similar consequences, credit bubbles, building and housing booms, and exploding markets. So what spread around the world throughout the global economy was, in a sense, the continuing effect of 9/11 and of the Isaiah 9:10 effect. But was it wrong, I asked? No more wrong than replacing fallen bricks with quarried stone or sycamores with cedar trees, if nothing more was involved. But there was something more involved, something much more involved. A nation was in spiritual decline and rapid departure from God. God was calling it back, allowing it to be shaken, to wake it up, to save it from judgment. But it chose instead not to turn back. And without turning back, all its efforts, all its campaigns become, in effect, acts of defiance, the undoing of symptoms, the silencing of alarms with no resolution of the underlying problem. The foolish gardener. The remedies only masked the problem, just as happened with ancient Israel. The Assyrian invasion was followed by a campaign to rebuild what had been destroyed. Fallen buildings, walls, towers, homes, a massive wave of construction throughout the land. Like a building boom, I said. Like a building boom. So too 9/11 not only resulted in the rebuilding of what had been destroyed, but beyond that, a massive wave of building throughout the nation. A building boom linked to the suppression of interest rates, linked to America's defiance of 9/11, linked to Isaiah 9:10 and to the words, "We will rebuild." And to the words proclaimed from Capitol Hill just days before the Treasury lowered the rate. Yes, said the prophet. And since the economic boom was linked to Isaiah 9:10, the Isaiah 9:10 effect, it ultimately had to collapse. The attempt of a nation to defy the course of its judgment apart from repentance will instead set in motion a chain of events to bring about the very calamity it sought to avert. The words of Isaiah 9:10 would lead Israel to its downfall, and all its rebuilding and all its prosperity would be destroyed. All the trappings of its national resurgence would then be exposed as having been hollow, empty, and deceptive from the start. A house of cards, I said. And so too in the case of America, he said. The extreme and prolonged lowering of interest rates would sow the seeds of future disaster. The explosion in credit would lead to a massive explosion in debt. The increased liquidity would mask a multitude of economic dangers. The standard cautions and restraints involved in borrowing and loaning would be thrown away. Banks would make loans they never otherwise would have made. Consumers would spend money they never otherwise would have spent. And people would buy houses they never otherwise could have afforded. Personal debt, government debt, and corporate debt all mushroomed. And with increased pressure to produce ever greater profits, investment and banking firms would become involved with increasingly risky transactions and practices. An economic house of cards. And just as Israel's resurgence was a house of cards, he said, so too was America's post-9/11 resurgence. As long as credit continued to flow, the stock market to rise, and the housing market to boom, the illusion could be sustained. But if the housing market stopped booming, if the stock market began to falter, or if the flow of credit began to dry up, the illusion would collapse. And so it did. In September of 2008, the American financial system began to implode, triggering the greatest economic disaster since the Great Depression. The American-led global economic explosion turned into an American-led global economic implosion. The house of cards was collapsing and drawing the world into its fall. And so behind the entire global economic collapse was Isaiah 9:10. It all began in the ruins of 9/11. Did anyone else see the connection between the economic implosion and 9/11? In time, it became clear to more and more analysts. One observer would put it this way: we can trace the roots of the crisis back to the 9/11 terror attacks. Greenspan kept on cutting the interest rates after September 11th, pushing financial innovation. After 9/11, American people were encouraged to spend in the spirit of patriotism to help restart the flailing economy. To fuel that spending, in the extraordinary political and psychological climate of that time, U.S. policymakers actively encouraged levels of borrowing and lending that would never otherwise have been allowed. Isaiah 9:10 translated into modern economics. Exactly, and from another source. The financial house of cards was slowly built following the 9/11 attacks. As the U.S. government tried to revive the economy by repeatedly dropping interest rates, families lunged at the opportunity to refinance their mortgages. Now the collapse of the mortgage market is felt around the world. Divine anger, I said, quoting what I had read, being a remedial force will not cease until its purposes are wrought out. If one expression is resisted, another must be found. And where did you get that? He asked. From a commentary in Isaiah 9:10. Very good, Noriel. So you've been searching. America resisted one expression, I said, so another was found. The warning was rejected, said the prophet. The stem was cut, but the root brought forth another. So the economic crisis that engulfed America and the world was, in a sense, the continuation of 9/11. Or 9/11 manifesting in the form of an economic collapse. Or, he said, that which first manifested as 9/11, now manifesting in an alternate form. There comes a second, I said. And notice, Noriel, the dynamic keeps getting larger. It begins with a voicing of the ancient vow. Then it becomes a direction, then the policy of an entire nation, and then a collapse affecting the course of the entire world. The harbingers draw in everything to themselves, from the Federal Reserve to the global economy. They touch the entire world, and no one realizes that it's all part of the ancient mystery. He didn't say anything in response, but reached into his coat, pulled out a seal, and handed it to me. I recognized it immediately. It was another of the nine harbingers. You realize you gave this one to me before as well? I asked. I do. So you recycle? He didn't respond to that either, though I wasn't surprised. You're giving me the seal of the sixth harbinger. That's correct. The fallen sycamore. The tree of Israel's judgment. And why am I giving it to you a second time? He asked. Because it has something to do with the second shaking? It does, he said, but also for another reason. What? Within the sycamore are two mysteries, one going back to the last days of ancient Israel, and the other going back to the first days. The first days of ancient Israel? The first days of America.